Okay.
I appreciate
it. I want to tell you there are certain things in this world that have a natural effect and you can't escape it. You know, people make jokes about the people falling asleep during the rabbi's drasha. I was writing my drasha for Shabbos and I fell asleep. That's a first. Imagine what's going to happen on Shabbos.
Good one. That's a finish. My famous story, Rabbi's cut late.
Right.
On the road test, he sees a bunch of cakes.
Okay. That's really a first.
You keep your hand in the middle on the board, right? So
okay. Start from something from the beginning of the Sedra, and if I'd like to say something about Tu B'Shvat, there's not going to be a shiur next week or the week after that. I think the week after that I'm going to be in the States.
And next week's elections?
The next week I'm leaving right after the elections, getting out of here fast. Okay. Moshe Rabbeinu is told that V'Arti Be'eretz Mitzrayim, the Rabbanu Shem tells him, B'Layla Hazeh, that he's going to go at midnight and kill the Bechoros. And Moshe Rabbeinu, when he tells the people, he says, Kachatzos Halayla and the Yosef Yisof Mitzrayim. About midnight.
Right.
Not exactly. Kachatzos. That's according to most. Some Mishonim learn Kachatzos means at the time that midnight, that the light, the night divides. Which means exactly at midnight. But Pashat is Kachatzos. So Rashi brings down the Gemara. That Moshe was afraid, or the Rav Amishon was afraid, that the Egyptian clocks would be wrong, and their clocks would be fast, and at exactly midnight, the Makkah wouldn't come on their clock, and therefore they would say Moshe Badoihu, Moshe's a liar. So, in order not to make it exact and to take into consideration their clocks may be wrong, Moshe said about midnight, so they couldn't point the finger and say that he's a liar if it didn't happen exactly at midnight. So they asked the question, L'cha'ora, what are we afraid of? That the clocks are going to be 5 minutes fast, so at 5 minutes to midnight, their clocks are going to say midnight, and nothing happens. So they're going to say, ah, Moshe's a liar, then 5 minutes later, all the Bechoros in Mitzrayim are going to die. So, what's it going to hurt? Right, in 5 minutes they're going to see the clocks were wrong. So there's two answers to that. One, the Shurei Das says that for 5 minutes in the world where people should say Moshe Badoi makes an impression that can never be corrected. So for those 5 minutes it's worth saying Kachatzos not to make that Chilul Hashem. Others say say it over, I heard it from my Rebbe in high school, Rabbi Groner, who now needs a Rafua Shlema. So he have a Rafua Shlema, the Maisa, but he, what's it called? He told me the following. I don't know if it was his own or whatever, but I know it in his name. He said that first impressions are always what a person's left with. He gave the example, I'm sure there's 1,000 other examples, but he gave an example from his time. He said there was a kosher delicatessen on the east side named what's it called? Oi. What?
Second Avenue Deli?
No. Famous, what's
Cats?
It called? What?
Cats?
Famous one from way back. Schmucke Bernstein. Years ago, they once supposedly caught him with treif. It was all the papers or whatever. In the end, it turned out that he was framed by a competitor who left a barrel of trefa stuff there, you know, and sent somebody to catch it or whatever. So everybody saw the headlines, you know, in the forward, right? Shmulka Bernstein, you know, what's it called, exposed for. And then when they put the retraction in, you know, 3 days later, nobody saw it. And even if they saw it, it didn't make any difference. Once you knew that Shmulka Bernstein was straight. Right? First impressions are an ikker. It's something a person should take in consideration when he goes on a job interview or on a shidduch, on a date, whatever. The first impressions are the ones that stay with a person. It's very hard to change first impressions. So therefore, if the people at midnight on their clock would have said Moshe Badoi, it's all a lie, Even if 5 minutes later, every Bechor in Mitzrayim would have died. But the first impression that Moshe's a liar, then the Naka would not have made the same impression. Yeah, it happened, but not the way he said it. And they wouldn't have come to the conclusion that their clocks were wrong. They should have said, yeah, fine, but it's not exactly, and if it's not exactly, then it doesn't make the same impression. Okay. That's one thing. Then right after that it says, Daber Noah Ba'oznei Ha'am, plead with the people. Ask them, please, right, that they should take gold and silver from the Egyptians. So Rashi brings down the Gemara in Brachas. The Gemara says, what's Daber Noah? Do I have to plead with them? Shalom Yomar Osu Tzadik, that Avram Avinu shouldn't say, you know, Rabbanu Shalom, you foretold to me that my children are going to be slaves and oppressed, right? And that you kept your word 100%. V'achrechen yetzu b'rchush gadol, but they're going to go out with great riches that you didn't wear Mekayim. I don't want to have Avram Avinu to have titus on me, so make sure they go and get gold and silver. So the obvious question is, first of all, what difference does it make if Avram Avinu has titus or not? The Rabbanu Shalom has to keep his word. He said, V'achrechen yetzu b'rchush gadol. So the simple answer could be, the Gemara says, why would you have to plead with them? I mean, get money, you have to plead with Jews to go get free money. So some say, yeah, if it's a mitzvah, yeah, people find excuses for everything, right? Even to get free money. When it's a mitzvah, right, I don't want to do it. There's no reason to do it. I remember in Miami, we had one glatt kosher butcher shop. And a lot of Jews said, I can't buy there, the meat's no good or whatever. Goyim used to come and buy there. The Goyim didn't have the Yetzer Hara, right? But it's a mitzvah, I'm not interested. That's what's a call. So even to get money, but others say what the Jews say, look, we don't need to go start getting money, just get us out of here. The Rashi brings down the marshal. The person who's in prison will tell him, look, wait till tomorrow, we'll let you out and we'll give you, you know, pizuim. Or you can go out now. Forget about the pizuim, just let me out of here. So the Yidden would be Mochel, but Avram's not Mochel, right? In Maisi, you weren't Makayim, so they gave up on it, but I'm the father, I want them to get it. That's, I think, the simplest answer. The another answer could be the following. The Dubna Magid says, but before I tell you the Dubna Magid, I'm going to connect it with what I want to say. Together they go very nicely. The Medrash says, way back in Lech Lecha, that the Rabbanu Shem told Avram Avinu that his children have a certain pagam, right? There's a certain something wrong with the Jewish people, and it needs to be corrected. And there's two ways that could happen. Either it could be corrected through Shibud Mitzrayim in this world, or it could be corrected in each one's neshama in the next world through Gehenna. So Avram was given the choice, which would you like for your children? Would you like the pagam, right, to be what's it called, corrected in this world through Shibud Mitzrayim? Now Avraham Avinu, according to one shot in the Medrash, said, I'd rather have my children take care of it in this world than the next world. Whatever you do in this world, no matter how bad it is, it's not as bad as what's in the next world. So Avraham Avinu chose Shibud Mitzrayim for his children. Now the Klal Yisrael could turn around and say, you know, what kind of father is this? What'd you do to us? So Avraham Avinu wanted the people to understand that he did it for their benefit. How did they know that they benefited from this? Because when they left Mitzrayim, they left with great riches. They wouldn't have gotten there. Couldn't have gotten had they not gotten out of there. Okay? Now the truth is that the real great riches that they left with was the Torah. They never could have received the Torah had that pagam, right, not been corrected. So that was the real rechush gadol that the Rabbanu Shalom meant. But there's another question over here. If God was so concerned that the people leave with money, why don't you just fill up their pockets with money? Why do you have to make them go and borrow it from the Egyptians? Well, the answer is that the Rabbanu Shalom wanted them to know that they gained something from being in Egypt that they couldn't have gained had they not been there. Had God filled their pockets with money, he could have done that anywhere. But to go and get it from the Egyptians, the only way you could do that is if you were in Egypt. So I want you to at least understand that you gain something by being here. This is not the main thing. The main thing is going to be later on when you get the Torah. But at least when you leave Mitzrayim, I could fulfill my promise by filling your pockets with gold and silver. But then you wouldn't have this idea that you gain something by being in Mitzrayim. And then Avram would have tainus. So in order that Avram shouldn't have tainus, because he's the one who chose this for you. And he wants you to understand. He wants his children to understand he did it for their good. The way that they understood that was when they left, they got something they couldn't have gotten had they not been there. That's the Dubna Magid adds a dimension to this. He says like this, he says, he's a marshal. He says there was a 5-year-old prodigy, a violinist. Okay, they could play violin better than the most accomplished adult. So a orchestra hired him to play violin, right, this 5-year-old. At the end of the month, the orchestra leader calls the kid in and presents him with a beautiful check for his month's work in the orchestra. Kid goes home crying to his father. He says, I worked hard with my violin for a month for these people, and he gave me a piece of paper. Father says, let me see the piece of paper. He looks at it and he understands it's a nice piece of paper, but the kid doesn't understand money. He calls up the orchestra leader. He says, listen, I'm putting this money in the bank for my child. Next month, don't give him a check. Send the check to me. I'll deposit it in his name. Give him a bag of lollipops and tell him this is his reward for playing violin. He'll think this is great. Big bag of lollipops, right? He's right now as a little kid. He doesn't understand what money is. Right? He only understands lollipops. Give him a lollipop and let him feel good. And later on, when he grows up, he'll understand what he really got paid for being a violinist. So too, Rav Amishlam said, for my sake, I promised them rechush gadol. I didn't mean gold and silver. I meant the Torah. That's the rechush gadol that they're going to be able to leave Mitzrayim with, that they're going to be able to receive the Torah. Had they never been there, had they hadn't corrected what's the word for
impagam?
Imperfection, right? Then they would never have gotten the Torah. So that's the real rechush gadol. But I don't want the father to ever complain, right? That they not on that level. With the Torah, that's a rechush gadol, a piece of paper, right? We want something, you know, really good. So the Rosh Hashanah said, look, for the sake of Avraham, I'll give him gold and silver now. But the truth is, for the sake of fulfilling what I said, that's going to happen, let's go later when they get the Torah. Okay. And it says that they should also take clothing, Egyptian clothing, and put it on their children. Now, it doesn't say that in our Sedra, except in the end. It says like this, when Moshe Rabbeinu was told what the sequence of Yetzias Mitzrayim is going to be, so he was told, I'm going to put the Chein Ha'am, the Egyptians will feel the Jews are charming and they'll want to loan them or whatever, and you should take from Egypt gold, silver, and clothing and put it on your children. Then in this week's Sedra, where Moshe tells the people to do that, he doesn't mention clothing. And then later on when they go and take it, it says again they took clothing. So two questions. First of all, what's the purpose of taking Egyptian clothing? Right? Why in the world would the Rabban Hashem want them to take Egyptian clothing and put on their children? For 210 years, one of the merits they had was not wearing Egyptian clothing. Now they're going to take it out of Egypt and put it on their children. So first of all, the Torah Tumima says, why put it on your children? He says, because the Egyptians wore mini clothes. So for the adults, they were very, very short. But if you put it on a child, it fit them perfectly. So he said that was the reason to put on the children. Okay. The Kli Yoker says that there was no command to take clothing. God just foretold to Moshe Rabbeinu what was going to be, and I'll tell you one second why. So when God told Moshe, this is what's going to happen, he told them they're going to take clothing. When it actually happened, it says they took clothing. When he gave them the command, he just said to create gold and silver, there was no command to take clothing. Why? How did the clothing get involved? The Egyptians thought this was a plague. What is the first thing you do with a plague? Burn the clothing because it's infected. Right, that's what spreads the plague. So the Egyptians thought that their houses were infected with a plague, and that's why their children died. So out of the goodness of their heart, they said, take our clothing. Right? They felt that they're going to infect the Jewish people like that. Yeah, we like you guys. Why don't you have some clothing? Right? So, and the Rav Hashem told Moshe, tell them not to be afraid. There's no plague over here. I killed the firstborn. There was no plague. The clothing is 100% okay. Don't worry. So there was never a command to take the clothing. Just the Rav Hashem foretold that when they go around to get the gold and silver, the Egyptians said, why don't you take some clothing also? Their intention was to infect them with the plague, right? Or to at least get it out of their house. And the Moshe, basically the Rav Hashem said, let them take the clothing. There's no problem with it. I have a different pshat, which I've said many times, probably here at least once. And that's, God wanted to teach us a tremendous lesson. why to take the clothing. God wanted us to know that clothing, there was nothing intrinsically wrong with it. Right? It was glatt kosher clothing. It couldn't have been not sandwa, because they couldn't have worn it or put it on their children. It couldn't have been shatnez, for the same reason. Anything that in the four halakim of the Shulchan Aruch would be wrong with clothing, couldn't have been wrong with that clothing. V'haraya, they wore it. They were supposed to wear it in the desert, put it on their children. What kind of chinuch is that? Yet, had they worn that same clothing the last 210 years in Egypt, they never would have gone out. How could that be? Either it's okay or it's not okay. The answer is, you don't judge things if they're okay or not okay on their intrinsic merit, but on what their implications are. Okay? I always like to tell the following story. When I was in high school, I'm sure some of you can share this, the rage in the world were the Beatles. Not the six-legged variety, but the two-legged variety. And the Beatles started a few different fads in the world. One of them was men started wearing long hair, growing long hairstyles. Up until that time, only hippies, bohemians had long hair. Right? Respectable businessmen, lawyers, doctors, businessmen didn't grow long hair for men. It wasn't in style. But once the Beatles, right, who the drummer Ringo Starr had long hair, right, and most of them had long hair also. So it became a fad in the world. People, you know, wanted to be like the Beatles, so they started growing long hair. And it became the fad in the world, became an acceptable thing for men to have long hairstyles, and whatever affects the Goyish world affects the Jewish world eventually too. So in the Masifta in Miami that I was attending, some of my friends stopped taking haircuts. They were also infatuated with the Beatles. And it was a Miami Masifta. It wasn't, you know, what's it called, Tells. It was, so they knew with the Beatles and they started not taking haircuts. And after about 3 months, it started looking like a co-ed school. And one day, my Rebbeim called in these group of guys, and they said to them, look, you go today, Friday, and go take a normal man's haircut for Kovod Shabbos. And then you can come back Sunday. If you don't go today and take a normal man's haircut, right, then don't come back Sunday. You're suspended until you get a haircut. You can't be in this school with long hair like this. So my friends were not daunted by that. And they said, but Rebbe, a Nazir is a holy man. And he grows his hair long. We just want to be like Nazirim. We just want to be holy. He said, you ever see the Rocket Chopper Gone? Rocket Chopper Gone had a head of hair that would make the Beatles, you know, look like short hair. They say that he never took off his yarmulke, so he couldn't take a haircut because he was always learning. A gigantic head of hair. So we want to be like the Rocket Chopper. So Rebbeim said, haircut or don't come back on Sunday. Why? Because it may be that if you look through the four halakim of Shulchan Aruch, there's really nothing wrong with having long hair. Could be there is. Shiloh with tefillin, with chukas hagoyim, whatever it may be, right? Blurious. But let's assume that none of that's a problem, right? That having long hair is not a problem. With tefillin, it's not a problem. With looking like a goy, whatever. That's okay. It's 100% okay from the four halakim in the Shulchan Aruch. But if the reason you're growing long hair is to be like the Beatles, that's treif. Same thing over here. The clothes may be 100% kosher. But if the reason you're wearing them is to be like an Egyptian, then it's treif. So if you wore that clothes in Egypt the last 210 years, you'd be wearing it to be like an Egyptian. That's no good. Now you're going into the desert. There are no Egyptians anymore. The clothes has no implication. There's no meaning to it. It's just clothes. Now you can judge it on its empirical, on its intrinsic value. That's what the Rebbe wants to teach us. You can't judge things in every time, in every place, the same way. Certain things may be 100% permitted in one place, in another place they imply something, they're awesome. And they're the opposite. Something may be awesome in one place because of their implication, and another place may be 100% okay because they don't have that implication. Right? When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so I went to buy sukkah decorations. I get to Meir Shorim, And I see that sukkah decorations look very familiar to me. As I get closer and closer, they look more and more familiar. There were Christmas decorations in the original package. They said Merry Christmas on them. And all these, you know, Yerushalmi Meyashorim people are buying them like they're who knows what. I was sure I was going to go Chol HaMoed and see a sukkah in Meyashorim with a little baby and some shepherds around or whatever. And right. And they would say, wow, got some mishpacha, you know, real nice sukkah decoration.
The Chabad Gan, they gave out a dreidel and played music.
Yeah, and there's Meshakovs here, they had, what's it called? Right, jingle bells, right. They don't know, or they had, what's it called? They have Santa Claus, right? The poor, they dress up as, they don't know who it is. There's some chassid with a red, bekisher. I remember years ago, and Avram was still living by us, that was mamish years ago, even it was the early time in Moshav, my youngest daughter, they used to have, now it's like a common thing, but then it wasn't so common, they used to have like once a year for a week, American week in the supermarket. They brought in American products, and you could go, and like it was like nostalgia, whatever. So my wife went, and we bought Quaker oats. Quaker oats, a picture of Quaker or the thing. And it was like a treat for the children. So my little daughter, she must have been about 4 or 5 years old at the time. So she comes running to me after I come home from davening. They're eating breakfast before going to school. She comes and says, Mommy bought cereal with the Kalava Rebbe on it. So that's, you know, we had what's it called, Chaim Ben Moshe, used to be Chaim Tittelbaum. So he went with me to the States to recruit for the Moshav. And we went right around December, you know, December 25th or whatever. And he told his son, he says, you know, after Christmas in America, they have real big sales in all the stores. I'm going to buy you something nice. The kid looked at him and said, what's Christmas? He never heard of it. So, you know, it depends where you are, what implication the thing has.
I once had asked you in reference to the colored bulbs that they like to decorate the slippers with. It's totally goyish, and that's how they do their houses. And you said the implication was that if it's like it brings to me the customs of the goyim,
right, then
I shouldn't
awesome.
Use them bichlal. Right. But the people that don't understand the implication of them, they're right. allowed to do. But the thing is, like, what do you do if you go to a sukkah and you're sitting there and you can't get out 25 years of working with goyim in your house, and you think you're sitting in the kitchen of a firehouse with Christians, and it's like I have a very difficult time doing
it. I hear.
It still gets into my shop.
For the people who know the implication, it's erechadami. For them, it's also
blinking lights.
Right. Okay.
Those
one last thing.
The clothing yeah. that they took. The
nation
also that this clothing grew then with the children, correct?
Yeah. That was the clothing, right.
So,
that it became a nace, right? Exactly. Yeah, and a chalam. All right, one last thing, a little bit about Tu B'Shvat. Since I'm not going to be here next week, and next week is Tu B'Shvat Shabbos, so we'll. The B'nai Yisoschar says that there is a connection between Tu B'Shvat and Tu B'Av. Okay, he says the world was created according to one opinion in Nisan and according to the other opinion in Tishrei. And the truth is that Tosfos says that they're both true. That one was created by Machshava, one by Maisa, which I don't want to go into now what that means. It wasn't created two different times, but it was created in two different dimensions at the same time because there was no time at the creation of the world. Time was a creation. So the world was created in two dimensions, the dimension of Tishrei and Nisan when time was created, so they drifted into two different time zones, but originally there were two dimensions. And the world wasn't really created in Nisan or in Tishrei, but if the world was created in Aleph Tishrei, it means man was created in Aleph Tishrei. That means the world was created 6 days earlier on Chof Hei Elul. If the world was created on Nisan, it means man was created on Aleph Nisan, and the world was created 6 days earlier on Chof Hei Adar. It says in the Gemara that 40 days before a person is conceived, they already start in Shamayim preparing for him. It says the B'nai Yisoschar, the same thing goes with the world. 40 days before the world was created and conceived, the Rebbe Shem started preparing in Shamayim for the world. What's 40 days before the 25th of Adar? Tu Bishvat. What's 40 days before the 15th, before the 25th of Elul? Tu B'Av. So those are the periods of preparation. Now, I want to take it further. There's another connection between them, besides the 40 days before the times of creation. Well, both of them have to do with trees. On Tu B'Av, one of the reasons that you celebrate it is because it's the siyum of cutting wood for the Mizbeach. Trees, eitzim, krisas eitzim lemizbeach, called eitzim, because eitz means the wood of the tree. You can have a dead tree, it's also called an eitz. And eitz is also wood, right? So they used to cut dry wood for the Mizbeach. That was the siyum. They didn't do it after that because the sun wasn't so strong and there could be worms or whatever, so they stopped on Tu B'Av. Tu B'Shvat is just the opposite. It's ilonos. It's trees that bear fruit, and it's because of the water that goes into the tree. So I want to say that there's something special about an eitz, and especially special about an ilon. And if you think about it, the words, ayin, if you vocalize the letters, ayin tzaddik. Eitz is look, you'll see a tzaddik. Ayin tzaddik. Look at the tree, and the word eitz, the way it's written in the Torah, looks like a tree. The ayin with the things coming up, it looks like branches and a bark or whatever, both letters. So ayin, look at this, you'll see what a tzaddik is. The word, okay, so let's see how that works. So the Maral says, the Torah compares people to trees. Ha'adam eitz asada. He says the comparison is that we really are configured like a tree, except upside down. We would be a tree, if you stood on your head, you'd look like a tree. You have your limbs standing up, your roots is your hair, right, facing downwards, your head, and you have a trunk and branches, right? So if you want to really look like a tree, you have to get on your head. So what did we learn from that? That the ikar of the tree is the roots, because you can cut off all the branches and the tree can still live. You cut off the roots, forget it. What's the root of a person? His head. We're not rooted in the physical world, says the Maharal. We're rooted in the spiritual world. So we're not an upside-down tree. Just that since we're in the physical world, our root faces where we really belong, in the spiritual world. So if you look at a tree and you see its configuration, where the root is and where the limbs are, and look at a person, you'll know what a tzaddik is. A tzaddik is somebody who's rooted in the spiritual world. That's the Maharal. So that's ayin tzaddik. Look at the tree and you'll see a tzaddik. Ilan, if you think about it, the last three letters of Ilan, this hit me one day on my drive in my car, Yud Lamed Nun, the last three letters, if you add them together, what do you get? 90. It's tzaddik. Take the tzaddik and put it back to the Aleph. What do you have? Eitz, with an Aleph. Aleph, instead of Yud Lamed Nun, you have the total of them is tzaddik. Now you have Aleph tzaddik. You have an Eitz, but it's not an Ayin tzaddik, it's an Aleph tzaddik Eitz. Okay, that's Ilan. Aleph means to learn. Now, Aleph Bina, right? Learn. Yolif in Aramaic means to learn. So now, if you take the Aleph Tzaddik, it means learn about the tree and you'll know what a Tzaddik is. How does that work? So we said in the past that there's two philosophies in this world. One is immediate gratification, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And the other is put in work in this world so you'll gain olam haba. This is not the world for immediate gratification. It's the world to put in effort for a later benefit. That's what the Mi'ri says, that the world to come is the fruit of this world. It's not a different world. Here you plant the seeds, there you get the results. So if you learn about the fruit-bearing thing of a tree, you'll understand what a tzaddik is. A tzaddik is somebody who's willing to put in work in this world for the next world and not looking for immediate gratification. He has that philosophy, the fruit philosophy of Olam Haba, and not the immediate gratification now. So learn about it. Now, just to add the icing on the cake, the Rabban Shem gave us four mitzvahs with fruit bring this message home.
Focus.
Okay, right. One is we do mitzvahs with the rachis, with the beginning of the fruit. Truma is called rachis. Bikurim, rachis, the first. Dedicate the first fruits to Hashem. You'll understand the concept of fruit is something holy, represents the world to come, right? The first, right? If you set the pattern in the beginning, everything after that comes, after that. That's the first. Then the Torah said dedicate the tenth, Maaser Rishon, the tenth. Why? Because the first is the beginning, the tenth is the end. You, from 1 to 10, all the integers are separate. At 10, you unite them all into one unit. So the beginning is Aleph, the end is Yud. So the Meiser, the 10th, dedicate to the Ribbono Shel Olam. You, now you start, you have the beginning dedicated to Hashem and the end dedicated to Hashem. Okay, now you have the right Hashkafa, everything is dedicated to Hashem. But you have to know how to, what to do. What does it mean to dedicate to Hashem? How to use the things in this world. So that's Meiser Sheni. What's the purpose of Meiser Sheni? Leman Tilmad Liyiras Hashem Elokecha. Should bring the Yerushalayim, that's where the yeshivas are, the Sanhedrin is, the Kohanim, and you'll learn how to be a Yirei Shemayim. So first have the right Hashkafas, then put it into practice. Go to Yerushalayim and learn how. That's Leman Tilmad Liyiras Hashem Elokecha. Then there's Meiser Ani. You can't do this just for yourself. You have to worry about other people too. So you have to give to other people also this chizuk or whatever. If you think about it, the four mitzvahs, the reishis, the meiser sheni, which is the learning, and the meiser ani, take the letters that would represent those mitzvahs. The reishis would be what? Aleph. The meiser would be yud. Laman tilmad, limud, islamid. And the nun is represents somebody who's falling. That's what Nun represents. Watch, right? The Nun is the middle letter in the Ani, because that's the focal letter. He's a fallen person. So the Nun represents Meiser Ani. What do you have? Elon. Aleph Yud Lamed Nun. So the Elon is the Aleph Tzaddik. Learn about the fruit. Keep the mitzvahs, you'll see what a Tzaddik is. And Ayin Tzaddik is Eitz. Look at it. If you look at the configuration, you'll also see what a Tzaddik is.